when we create, we are again becoming creator-like. And so that's an incredible power and dignity that we're afforded. And the most beautiful and important and in fact necessary and only way is really to make it praise.
Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Memoirist Carolyn Weber is the author of Surprised by Oxford and more recently, Sex in the City of God. She's a professor at New College Franklin in Franklin, Tennessee. This conversation between Dr. Weber and me was recorded in front of a live audience at New College Franklin.
Carolyn Weber, thank you for being on the Habit Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Yeah, and so we are at New College Franklin on a Monday evening, I don't know when this is going to air, but we are in person. We're not on Zoom, and we have a lovely audience. So, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You're interested in Augustine coming and going. It seems to me, right? You do spiritual autobiography and. Of course, Augustine is sort of the great granddaddy of spiritual autobiography. Mm. The title of your most recent memoir is Sex in the City of God, mm-hmm. An obvious reference to Augustine. So I'd love to think a little bit about Augustine and what Augustine means to you, how his way of thinking about the world has shaped your way of thinking about the world and your work as a writer. But let's just start with this idea of spiritual autobiography or spiritual memoir. Mm-hmm. That's your wheelhouse, or has been.
It has. I sort of tumbled into that wheelhouse. Uh-huh. Sort of, woo. It wasn't something I anticipated doing because I had always been an academic by trade. But uh-huh. then I never anticipated writing spiritual memoir. And I think there really is an archetypal movement behind spiritual memoir where actually once we start writing about looking at God's work in our lives, it tends to actually take that Augustinian shape, you know, which is actually Pauline, right? It's based on Paul's story of God's testifying to God's work in his life. So for the last book, Sex in the City of God, I never anticipated either writing a book with the word sex in the title. As a literature person, there's a lot of things in life that surprise you. but I think it was working with my publisher. We liked the pun. I mean, Sex in the City is such a, if you're familiar with that kind of notion, you know, in the TV world of, mm-hmm. Relationships that are glorified for being transient and kind of this media representation of love. And I thought that it was really interesting to think, well, what happens, though, if we set it within the Augustinian notion of the city of God, mm-hmm. And the ordering of our loves, thinking about it in a different way? And those are two very, very different worlds, the city of man and the city of God. And where our citizenship is what determines how we love. Mm-hmm. And how best we love. And we tend not to think about that. And it's not that necessarily we need to be heavy-handed about it as Christians, but it's a game changer. You know, so what happens is we have all these messages about sort of the empty forms of loving, mm-hmm. if I use that term really broadly, as opposed to thinking about the eternal forms of them.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, I mean, that is, as you said, the shape of Augustine's Confessions. Mm-hmm. I mean, as the various ways that he sought to help me out with the beginning. We are made for new college students. Yeah.
we are longing. Find
right.
Until
yeah,
find
our hearts are restless. So they find their rest mm-hmm. in God and Augustine, as you said, he mm-hmm. didn't originate this idea.
No.
He put it as clearly as anybody ever did. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as you said, this is a way of telling the story of a life mm-hmm. that you have found useful, that mm-hmm. Augustine found useful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's not a question, I don't guess.
That's a statement.
Floor is now open.
Well, I think I was blown away by the fact, I mean, I used to think before I was a believer, that a lot of phrases that believers use are super creepy.
Okay.
You know, things like being married to God or loving God first or whatever. You think, okay, sure, he's not tangible. This isn't realistic. Mm-hmm. How am I single in this world and expected to be single? How, if I'm married, am I expected not to have these, you know, other desires or whatever? And as opposed to, it really hit me that when you do become a Christian, you are married to Christ first. All your decisions and all of that are made with him, in relationship to him. And again, that changes everything. And so regardless of your status, your relational status in the world, you're already married.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real eye-opener for me because it really, I was really touched and moved by Augustine's restlessness, but then also his love when he did find that love and realized how much he had been loved, and that desire then to order your loves according to that first commandment. I mean, the commandments are in order for a reason, mm-hmm. and that primary first commandment of loving God before everything else, and anything else except that love is an idol. It's so easy for those things to sound trite. You know, it's like how we kind of quote Shakespeare and we don't realize actually how beautiful it is. You know, I'm amazed at how the biblical truths are like an electric socket that we put our finger into, and they really are real. And that first commandment orders all the others. And it doesn't, again, matter if you're dating, single, anything else, that first love is so primary and important and orders all the others and orders our hearts. That was an eye-opener for me, and so I wanted to explore that further.
Yeah. Okay. So, I don't know if what you said is a clue to this question or not, but what is the difference between memoir and spiritual memoir?
Well, memoir and autobiography, there's a slight difference between the two genres, because autobiography implies in many ways more of chronological or fact. And again, mm-hmm. fact is a really tricky thing to define, whereas memoir comes from memory, and we all remember things differently, right? If you think about even going back to your childhood, we've probably all had an experience where you return to a place, a locus of some place that's been meaningful to you as a child. And when you go back there as an adult, it's so much smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The little water fountain in your school, or, you know, that tree in the backyard, or your childhood
home. The hill
home.
Isn't nearly as steep as you thought it was.
No, right? The snow that you thought as a Canadian was up here is actually down here.
Yeah.
That you had to trudge through. And so memory is different for all of us. And that doesn't necessarily make it right or wrong. There's ways in which we remember things. But what I'm also really amazed at with memoir is how you can explore what's significant to you. But I also really agree with C.S. Lewis, looking back and being able to plot God's work in your life,
mm-hmm.
Which I think memoir allows you to do in a more overt way, looking at how really we are all stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're nothing but stories, essentially. And so the meaning in that story, as opposed to simple chronological
mm-hmm.
fact.
So, okay, here's a question I've wanted to ask a spiritual memoirist before.
Uh-oh.
So here's my chance. what pressure do you feel? Or,
right now or in general?
what pressure does one feel to make the facts of your life adhere to a, say, Augustine's pat, right? I mean, when Augustine wrote his confessions, Christian people for centuries since have kind of said, okay, here's how you do it. You show yourself wandering around, and then you find God, and then some new things happen.
To
what extent do you have feel the freedom to say, here's what I saw, I'm bearing witness to what happened in my life.
Mm-hmm.
In the places where that doesn't fit the narrative that it's supposed to fit, what do you do with that? Or do you find that it always does fit?
That's a great question. Because it's not formulaic. And I think all of our testimonies are beautiful and important. All our stories are in God. They're like fingerprints. Mm-hmm. And they somehow, again, fit then in this archetypal way. My mother, for instance, prayed for me my whole life, just like Augustine's mom. Never underestimate the prayers of a mother. But my mom was not a believer until just very recently. Does that mean her prayers were empty or worthless or superstitious or irrelevant? No, I know God uses everything and nothing's wasted. But all it does is it connects me even more so to the humanity of someone like Augustine, even over hundreds of years, because there's that thread of understanding. Like Lewis says, you know, we read to know we're not alone, but we're also so connected in the various ways in which we are loved and mm-hmm. in which we do remember both suffering and meaning. I agree with Viktor Frankl that suffering that has meaning can be endured. Mm-hmm. And so when we give meaning to something, even in retrospect, that's God's way of illuminating him at work in our lives. So I think all writing, like all forms of art or expression or mimesis, are forms of praise. Mm. And so when we write or we share our testimonies, that's a particular form of praise.
What do you mean when you say all mimesis is a kind of praise?
Well,
should explain what mimesis means first.
New
College people all know, but some of my listeners may not.
Right, imitating, making an image of, or made in the image of God, and then I think that the things that we create are further emanations of being makers ourselves in the image of God, the great mm-hmm. maker. And one of the great dignities we have is not only our free will and our decision whether or not to follow God, because he's always there. He hasn't gone anywhere. You know, in Eden, he was asking where we went, not him. But we, when we create, we are becoming creator-like. And so that's an incredible power and dignity that we're afforded. And the most beautiful and important and in fact, necessary and only way is really to make it praise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You spoke of, you know, looking back to find meaning. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that that's kind of the only way we can see the meaning is to look back? I mean, as we're, what's the saying? We live life looking forward, but we can only understand it looking back.
You ask good questions. it's not the only way, but I think, especially for someone like myself, so fallible, where faith is sometimes very difficult. You know, faith going forward without seeing.
Yeah.
Looking back is a way of seeing in which mm-hmm. I have more control and I've been given the grace of being able to see mm-hmm. as opposed to living forward by faith, which is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like looking for the light switch in the dark as opposed to being in the room where you go back and you know where it is. You know, I think there's a great grace afforded in that, in ourselves being able to remember. I think it's really, really powerful when we look at even the liturgy in the church or the sacraments and things, you know, to remember me, to be put back together, to mm-hmm. remember is very much memoir.
Yeah.
You know, and as Lewis again says, you know, that the Lord says, take and eat, not take and think. You know, it's almost very primal for us. There's a way in which we need that story. We need that meaning like we do the living water or the bread.
Yeah. Yeah, in memoirs, you said it's just the French word for memory.
Exactly.
It's just looking back and saying, these things happened.
Yes.
And now I'm ready to look back and see what they meant.
Yes.
And understand.
Yeah.
Still might get it wrong. Mm-hmm. You still not mean?
Absolutely, but more than not, we're gonna have our socks knocked off by how gracious it's been.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. In another interview you did with somebody else, you quoted, I guess it was Coleridge.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't quite know what this means, but I think it's really interesting.
Okay, probably was.
You tell me what it means.
If it's Coleridge, it's got to be interesting.
That's right. Selection is the hardest part of creation.
Yes. I always say that to my students when they're editing.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. They know because they're cringing. Right? The most painful part is everything that's on the cutting room floor, right? Mm-hmm. Only you have to live with what you didn't include. And he said, the process of selection is the most difficult thing because you live with what you omitted or didn't include or felt that you could have included better. So I think that in writing, that's incredibly difficult. One of my best friends always says to me, you know, with your first manuscript, put it in a golden chest because it's going to be way too long and difficult and messy for anyone else.
Yeah.
But it's still something about that is something that you love and got everything out. But then you want to think about what actually you want to publish. So that kind of art of selection, I think, is a really painful and personal process for an artist.
And of course, as a memoirist, you've got a whole life to select from. And thankfully, you don't put your whole life into the book.
No, that would
for be... For lots of reasons.
Yes. Anne Lamott said, write as though your parents are dead. but I find that one. But Madeleine L'Engle said, write as though your children will read it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do those two circles overlap anywhere?
I do think I try to write memoir according to the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say unto others what you would have said unto you. And if you can't say something pleasant, and it's really necessary that you can't say something pleasant for the story or to make a point, then change any identifying factors or characteristics. And one of the best pieces of advice I had from a really wonderful person in the writing business that I admire was to never write from anger either, which I think is, you can journal from anger.
Sure.
And I'm sure Augustine journaled a lot. I'm sure his mother did too. But journaling is one place, but writing in the public sphere is another.
Yeah. Have you ever had an editor say, are you sure you want to say this?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us more about that.
Great. So you want me to talk about what was not selected?
You know what I'd like to hear? Was there anything that you, any time where you chose not to select something, you left it on the cutting room floor and then later said, I wish I'd brought that back. Or wish I'd saved that.
Rarely. In that, not that I'm a particularly talented writer, it's just that I had very, very good friends that I trust in Christ who were correct in telling me to leave it on the floor. I was always right in fellowship.
Always right in fellowship.
We're always right in fellowship. Always have people you trust reading those golden chest manuscripts. People who say, I wouldn't say this, or I would temper that. People who know and love you, some people who know and love your world. And I think in that sense, I haven't had regrets about what was not included.
Mm-hmm.
I've had very wise advice or guidance on what not to include.
You've said you write in community. What was the word you
fellowship.
Write in fellowship, yes. The writers that you're in fellowship with, are they people that you see in person? Or, of course, you just moved to Tennessee, so you don't have anybody to...
No, but there were lots of friends here already.
Yeah.
I've actually already shared a poem with somebody in this room.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did they like it?
They haven't told me yet.
Oh. You're in question time. They can come up.
I'm trying to see where they're sitting. We're going to chat about it. But, yeah, it's vulnerable to share your work.
Yeah.
Sometimes in person, I commuted with a dear friend of mine, so she was trapped in a car when we would work together at the seminary, so she had to give me feedback. It's really wonderful to trap your editors.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but I also think, I think sometimes professional, and what I mean by professional editors are people who are working maybe for a publisher or whatnot and want you to be... socially palatable or marketable or whatever as well. And so you really have to pray or think through that too. I remember with Surprise by Oxford, I had an editor who really did not want profanity in the book. I can't believe I'm talking about profanity and sex, and I'm like a literature professor. but I was quoting someone, and I felt it was really important. And it was, but they were a fairly conservative editor. And I certainly understand that. It's not something I would do lightly or gratuitously.
Sure.
So sometimes those kind of tensions, especially in memoir when you're trying to be truthful, represent somebody and you feel like that's an important characteristic to have, and yet also trying to think and pray over what's really necessary or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this distinction you're drawing between the comments that your fellowship of writers give and mm-hmm. the comments that your editors
sometimes, yeah,
give.
Yeah.
Do you have any more to say about that?
I think if you're working with a professional editor and you have a great rapport, that's a huge blessing, mm-hmm. because then you can work with someone who can help, who can meet you and understand artistically what you're trying to do, and yet also can work with you in terms of what they feel is necessary. But I also have my friends that I go to that I know will talk to me in a very personal way about the reading.
Yeah. And editors are so overworked. I've been in editor's office and see the stacks of manuscripts and said, wait, this is what you're supposed to be reading and dealing with? And mm-hmm. it's staggering.
Absolutely. They're overworked. And sometimes, too, you're asking them to come into a world that is very, very unfamiliar for them, just mm-hmm. as it would be vice versa for you.
Sure.
I remember working with an editor as well when I was trying to describe Oxford, and they just thought there was way too much alcohol involved in the story. Again, wow, I'm on a real theme here. Yeah. Sex, profanity, and alcohol, but I've just like left the Baptist seminary and snapped, but... I understood what they were saying, but they didn't realize that I really did have something like a sherry allowance on my scholarship that allowed me to purchase sherry to have with my professor, or that there was a pub in every college, because as the porter put it, we'd much rather track our own drunks than have them wandering around Oxford. So there is that reality, but this particular editor thought that that couldn't be the case. So sometimes it's just working with someone and you're trying to be realistic in what you're describing, but they have maybe some other cultural mm-hmm. concerns.
Yeah. I know the editors I've known have very much cared about what they were doing, loved what they were doing,
Absolutely.
And sometimes were just so incredibly overworked. But anyway.
Absolutely true, yeah.
Okay, another thing I've heard you say that I found very interesting was you talk about the importance of noticing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad anybody who teaches writing is talking about noticing, paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And what a phrase I've heard you use is noticing how everything tips toward grace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I just think it's so incredibly superfluous. I mean, I think things like birdsong, you know, there's mm-hmm. no real reason for birdsong. I mean, yes, mm-hmm. you can talk about mating and all that kind of thing, but really there isn't.
No reason it should appeal to us, even
right.
if it appeals to the birds.
Right, or be so incredibly beautiful that it stops you in the middle of a lecture or something. That we have enough oxygen to breathe, that we have everything in place for sustaining life. And we are a fallen and broken world. Actually, I was amazed at how much Genesis made sense to me when I first read it as an unbeliever. Mm-hmm. I was prepared to really hate it and be upset by it and think that it would be fodder for arguing against the world or the scientific world. But actually, a post-lapsarian world makes all the sense in the world
mm-hmm.
in terms of how we function right now. That there is enough equilibrium for us to survive and even thrive, and the fact that, you know, we see suffering is not the norm, but also that that there's an equilibrium that we all long for. You know, again, that Sehnsucht, that German word for longing or infinite longing that Lewis writes so much about, but that there is this longing we have for home, there is this longing we have for something beyond ourselves that we can't quite name, but everything kind of points to that. And as he says, you know, all joy reminds, and there are that we live in a world that has joy, mm-hmm. seems incredibly generous to me.
Yeah.
Given the depth of our darkness.
And it takes a little practice to notice and pay attention to that mm-hmm. abundance.
Absolutely. Friedrich Buechner said that the most important thing a writer can do is really a spiritual discipline of just paying attention. Mm-hmm. Just pay attention. And I think if you pay attention, that's where I realize how incredibly generous it is.
Yeah. Yeah, there's the idea, I'm going to get this, who knows how this is going to go, but you know, and now I can remember if this is Augustine or Aquinas, but the idea that things exist, we see things because they exist, but things exist because God saw them.
Mm.
And as we look, we are seeing what God saw into being, or that God saw, and as we think, we're thinking God's thoughts after him, and as we you've already said all mimesis is a kind of praise. As we make, mm-hmm. we are figuring forth the image of God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think these are really helpful things for a writer, mm-hmm. A writer or also a human being.
Mm-hmm. it's the old form of seer. You know, I mean, we think a prophet or seer, but being God sees who we really are.
Mm-hmm.
He knows who we really are. So again, when we think of, you know, Peter and his betrayal and then being reinstated, but God always has seen that. Is that how we love others as well? You know, Jesus meets us where we're at. I'm always amazed. I love the Gospels so much. I mean, go figure. That's an understatement of this millennium. But I mean, Jesus is just really cool. You know, like he's really cool. Like he doesn't walk up to anybody and say, "You stink." He has every right to. And we do, but he meets us where we're at, and he meets us so profoundly and so individually, and so personally, and he's never inconvenienced or hurried in that. And there's a real way, are we meeting people where they're at? Are we paying attention in mm-hmm. that way?
Yeah.
Are we actually looking past? And again, I think of Milton, right, Potentes, but I think of that notion of are we really, the weight of glory, are we really meeting people as other immortals?
Yeah, and I think this is especially relevant for a memoirist. It's so important that we see what we actually see, that mm-hmm. we don't see what we think we're supposed to see.
Right.
And that as we tell us our own story, mm-hmm. we tell, you know, in what is it that the Peace Like a River, you know,
yes.
where he says, mm-hmm. that, I guess it's Sweet, I guess. Is Sweet the narrator? Who's the narrator?
Oh, I read it years ago. Yeah, Sweet, okay. the little girl.
Yeah. That, what's her name?
Is it
Reuben? Is the boy, right?
Isn't it told through the eyes of the girl? I can't remember. It's years ago. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Reuben then.
I was thinking maybe it's both, but maybe.
Yeah. One of them, the narrator, says...
It's years ago.
Here's what happened. Make of it what you will. Or mm-hmm. is it,
right. You know, that's right. I remember that passage. Yeah.
Yeah,
it will bear testimony.
I saw what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I understand it or not, here's what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you use the word seer, and I'd never thought about it until you said it. I mean, we usually use the word seer to mean someone with some sort of special vision or a prophet or something like that. But the truth is, if you actually are seeing what you see, that's an almost prophetic act. It's so rare and unusual to actually pay attention to. I mean, as you said, the way we look at people, we've already got our categories, and we see just enough to mm-hmm. figure out which of our categories to put them in.
Mm-hmm.
Although
mm-hmm.
none of us think that we belong in any of those categories, right?
Right.
There's no category for me, but I've got categories for everybody else.
Right.
Unless I actually pay attention mm-hmm. and see mm-hmm. who people really are. And then I've got something, if I am actually seeing, now to bring this back, since this is a podcast about writing,
mm-hmm.
I always say your goal as a writer is to give readers something they couldn't get for themselves. for whatever reason, right? Mm-hmm. And often it's just they haven't taken the time to pay attention.
Right, right.
And that's the job of the writer is to pay attention for people who don't.
I agree, and I think one of the great gifts of writing is that sometimes the paying attention comes through the writing itself.
Yes.
You know, as Langle said, that sometimes there's the epiphany comes as you just trust the writing. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, again, if you think about Paul and his conversion, he was there at the martyrdom of Stephen, and Stephen's face is described as glowing like an angel's. Well, did he recognize that at the time, or did he recognize that later as a result of having witnessed the martyr and then later having the conversion? Who knows? But we know that the glowing happened for whatever reason it has. So sometimes there's convergences in which we just don't understand. And that's what I mean by how incredibly bigger than us it is and how much more gracious and generous it is.
Yeah.
It's not petty.
What's not petty?
All of this. You know. Yeah. I do agree with Lewis in The Great Divorce that that's why the Bright Lady of Heaven can't fit into hell. She just doesn't fit.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow. You're right. Big world.
Big world. Big God. It's expanding.
Okay. Carolyn Weber, who are the writers who make you want to write?
Gosh. Well, there's so many. I mean, it's so easy to say famous ones, and there's also there's so many. I mean, I have the privilege of reading students' writing, and they'll have a sentence that they say or write that pops out at me and changes my whole thing. So I think this the privilege of reading other people's ideas in general are wonderful. Of course, I'm going to say Milton.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Not because we have to say Milton, and not because I'm struggling under an anxiety of influence like Keats, because I gave up writing like Milton years ago. but I have always been struck by rhythm and by trying to make the big accessible.
Uh-huh.
So I admire writers that talk about profound things in really accessible ways, almost sneakily accessible ways. Mm-hmm. So someone like C.S. Lewis I adore because I think he's really erudite and highly accessible. I think Madeleine L'Engle the same way, especially in her Crosswicks journals and her personal memoir writing. Mm-hmm. Interesting, too, when we were talking about memoir with Lewis and Surprised by Joy. I love Frederick Buechner as well. For that reason, that there's almost a grittiness and an everydayness, and how he can remember the color of the pants he was wearing when his father committed suicide. Those little things that he still somehow weaves into God's glory, into our push and pull, our consolation and desolation with God. So many beautiful writers. But I do find faith writers, it's not like people of faith are perfect by any means, but at least we're trying. And I feel like that makes all the difference, trying in the trying sense, not hopefully trying in the annoying sense, but maybe both. But there's, I think, because when I read writers without at least that sense of faith. I mean, everything points to the glory of God. I haven't read a single thing that actually hasn't ever, even tragedy or, you know, something despairing or, you know, I mean, take Anna Karenina and that just proves all the more, right? The love of God for us and what we want to pursue and have in the ordering of our loves. But I think with there's a way in which those of faith who have a larger meaning, a larger framework, a larger intent and purpose and awareness of the significance of words ultimately speaks to me more.
Can we return to this idea of student writing being an inspiration to you as a writer?
Yes.
I mean, it is... One thing that's interesting about academic writing is we have to set things up so that mm-hmm. people don't have to be brilliant and say things that have never been said before mm-hmm. in order to get by, right? You can't require of your students that mm-hmm. that every day, for every assignment, they say something that's never been said before and it's brilliant.
Sure you can.
Oh, okay. Tell me about that. How do you get that? How do you get that out of your students?
We're Christians. We're used to the high bar.
Yeah, okay. All right. This question is over, apparently. But as you said, the days that somebody does say something that you've never thought before mm-hmm. is so incredibly inspiring. It makes it feel like, I'm really glad I came to work today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about editors being overworked, students are overworked far more. Mm. In our culture, we're tired. Like, one of the things I was surprised at when I studied in England was, sure, later as I was teaching and it was busy and that sort of thing, but when you first come in under the British Academy, you're not allowed to hold a job. They have this crazy idea that you should actually just be a student. And there is something to be said for that and the roots in classical education that way, you know, Schola mm-hmm. and time and meditation and fellowship and you know, even walking to a pub and talking about a tutorial is a wonderful, rich thing that we don't always allow for in our lives. And so, sure, there are a lot of caffeinated sentences in all of our writing,
yeah, right.
especially as North Americans.
Yeah.
But there's also such a privilege in hearing people's ideas and seeing the glimmers and the glints that they are striking at as well. And when those kernels come up, they are really wonderful. Everybody feels them if we share them as a class. But it's not like you have to be, you know, T.S. Eliot calls a poem an experience, right? It's not like right. you have to be constantly in a circus. But there is this way in which we're all sort of feeling through the dark in that sense. And when there's a glint, it's really powerful for everyone involved. And I do love seeing my students chase through a thought or an idea because you never know which one is actually going to be the one that they pursue further. And we can downplay it. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing what we take for granted. It's amazing that we would all be in this room together and everything in the entire cosmos is lined up so that would happen.
Yeah.
And we just take it for granted all the time.
Yeah.
And so even reading a paper or an idea or whatever doesn't mean it has to be intense pressure, but it just means, I mean, I can remember a professor changing my life by engaging in something he thought it was wrong in a paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually was a real catalyst for looking for Christ many years later in my life.
Hmm. I love it when students realize there's this conversation that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm jumping into the middle of it.
Right.
And I've got a little something to contribute.
Right.
Which is true for students and it's true for the rest of us.
Yeah.
So. Well, Carolyn Weber, thank you so much for spending this time. And thank you to the audience here at New College Franklin for being here. And I hope we can talk again soon.
Me too. It's a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much.
This podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And all our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate. Special thanks as well to Taylor Linhart for letting us use her song Diamonds as the theme music for season 3 of The Habit Podcast. You can learn more about Taylor and follow her work at taylorlinhart.com.
The Habit membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.